Thank you. My name is Maren Harwood, grateful recovered alcoholic. Is this going to be loud enough?
Yeah, we're good. Great.
My guy's in the front. All right, cool. So I thank the group for asking me to be here, and more than anything else, really thankful that God saw fit to remove my obsession for alcohol and its derivatives. Let's call it that. I have respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA. I'm a student of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife calls me an AA nerd. I love everything about it. And I especially love the fact that groups are in place and they say certain things during the openings. So we're going to leave it at that. When I say alcohol, it could include any other number of things, right? Let's just call it that. Anyone wants to get into that, those outside issues, because that's what they are. So not breaking any traditions, we're going to keep it to just alcohol for the next 10 weeks or so. How's that sound? Hope I don't slip. I might. And I'm going to try to curb my language to not be salty. That's difficult for somebody like me. I'm going to try, though. Do my best, because we're being recorded. I'm going to make sure. Okay. So let's discuss my story. And I'm going to tell you my story very briefly. Every time I put alcohol in my system, I didn't know how many it was going to take. Every time I tried to stop on my own, I couldn't. I'm a real alcoholic. No other way around it. I was talking with someone the other day, someone who's newer in the program, and they said, well, I was a functioning alcoholic. I'm like, there is no such thing. You're either alcoholic or you're not. It's like being pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not, right? Just putting a word in front of alcoholic doesn't make it any different, right? Because someone's a recovered alcoholic doesn't mean any different than someone who is recovering alcohol. Call yourself whatever you want. Put whatever word in front of it that you want to. Functioning, active, call it whatever you want. The word alcoholic is the important part, right? There's only two reasons why people drink again. They don't know what their problem is, right? And they don't know what the solution is, right? That's what this book explains. Right. This book explains both of those masterfully. In fact, if you go to the Library of Congress, top 100 books that were ever written, this is one of them. Right? I mean, if you really think about what this book has done, right, what has it really done, if you think about it? There are, I think it's 200-something 12-step fellowships. About. And that number is increasing exponentially because of the, you know, obviously the treatment center world. They like to be able to slap any sort of copay they can onto whatever illness you may have. But it all came from here, right? If anyone's ever been to an outside issues meeting, CA, HA, OA, what book do they use? This one. They just change the language a little bit, right? They used to say overeating instead of alcohol or whatever other outside issue, right? And the reason is because this book contains those two things. If someone wants to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to talk about their day, right, they've gotten some bad information. That information says that someone else's story, right, can keep you sober. I'm not going to tell you my story. It can't even keep me sober. Why would I tell you my story? Right, I can tell you my experience. Right, that's all I really have. If someone's experience is being able to go to 90 meetings and 90 days and be happy, joyous, and free, and never drink again, rock on, go for it, love it. It's not what the book says, but that's okay. I love it, awesome. Right, but if someone's experience is different than say mine, right, I've been taking bullets, for lack of a better term, in Alcoholics Anonymous since December 27, 2014. Because my experience is a little bit different. My experience I talk about God and I talk about the 12 steps. Right? Not everyone is going to like that. And that's okay. You don't have to like it. But my experience is really one that comes from here, from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So here's how I was thinking, right? There's maybe my first problem, right? But the idea is, how do I, right, in let's say 10 weeks, describe the program of action? I've done big book studies since I got out of rehab in early 2015, right? And I told my sponsor, I was like, there's not enough big book studies around. He's like, well, start one. Well, that's a novel idea, right? So I did. I sat down with two other people for many weeks, and we studied this book. It grew a little bit. We got some groundswell, right? But we studied this book over and over and over again. I say this book led me to a bigger book, and that's the dictionary. I looked up words that I thought I knew what they meant, but I really didn't. I really didn't have a firm grasp of what it was that I was reading. It's like if someone were to hand me something difficult, a physics textbook, right? Hand me a physics textbook, and I read the book, right? I don't look up any words. I don't ask anyone else about their experience with that. I don't ask a teacher, someone who's gone through and taught that book before, any questions. Am I going to have a firm understanding of physics when I'm done with the book? No. I'm not going to. Because I haven't had any sort of experience with it. I've just kind of read the words, right? It's one thing. It tells us in, right, these are the steps we took, not these are the steps we studied. I understand that. I get that, right? The studying is to be able to explain this, right? Bill Wilson, our founder, tells us, what is my number one job in AA? To give an accurate representation of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the goal. How can we, right, recovered alcoholics, people who are recovering, or people who are just looking to carry the message, or maybe want something just a little bit more, quote-unquote, from AA, right? That changes a little bit later on. I came to AA to get something from it. It turns out that has nothing to do with it. I come to AA to give to it. Right? It's a little bit different than what I thought. I thought I'd come to AA and be like, all right, give me the one-liner that's going to take me the rest of the 23 hours till my next meeting. Like, that's what I'm thinking, right? Tell me a nice little antidote or some little, or halt, right? Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You guys ever hear that before? Right? If you're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, you're going to drink again. Like, I disagree. I'm alcoholic. I'm built to drink again. It's in my wiring to drink again, right? That's the whole thing. Birds fly, fish swim, alcoholics drink, right? I gotta know the problem. The problem's not alcohol, right? It's not. Every time I relapsed, I did it one way, sober. That's the number one cause of relapse, by the way. Sobriety. Right? My sober mind said alcohol's a good idea. That's a problem. That's a major problem. And we overlook that when we come into AA. How was your day? How are you feeling? Like, none of that matters if I'm alcoholic. Anyone ever drank when they felt great? Anyone ever drank when they felt, no bad words, bad? Right? Anywhere in between, got the job, didn't get the job, got the girl, didn't get the girl, right? No matter what, I was drinking. I'm alcoholic, right? The problem is not alcohol. Because if alcohol was the problem, all I have would need one detox and I'd be okay, right? I would just not drink again, right? The doctor's opinion, which we'll go through in the next few weeks, is masterful at telling me exactly what the problem is. It tells me that I'm restless, irritable, and discontented until I could feel the effects of ease and comfort that come at once by taking a couple drinks. That which I see others taking with impunity. Right? So I watch other people drink and I'm like, well, that's, yeah, that I can do. Right? I'm restless, irritable, discontented. I'm angry. I'm upset. I'm grumpy. I'm anxious. I'm depressed. Fill all that stuff in. That's what we suffer from. I'm looking to get ease and comfort. The question is, whether you've been sober 24 hours, right, 24 weeks, 24 months, 24 years, you follow, right? Restless, irritable, discontented is the problem. That's the enemy. That's why we drink. I'm looking for, it tells me in the doctor's opinion, two things, ease and comfort. So the question would be, no matter how long you've been sober, where are you getting your ease and comfort? Is it the zeros in the bank account? Is it the spouse at home? Right? Is it the Volvo and 10 beautiful vehicles I saw out there in the parking lot? Right? Is it the Calvin Klein I'm wearing? Where am I? What is it? Where am I getting my ease and comfort? 10 energy drinks a day? Right? Fried chicken? They call it comfort food. Come on. Like, where am I getting my ease and comfort? Is it from God? Well, there we go. Am I getting my ease and comfort from sitting down with a newcomer and listening to them spout all the stuff on why they drink? Oh, I drink because of this. And it's like, okay, like all those things exacerbate alcoholism. I get it, right? The way we were raised, our parents, the school we went to, the things that happened to us, yes, that exacerbates it, no problem. It adds fuel to the fire. But if you're adding fuel to a place where there's no flames, it doesn't matter. Fire doesn't get any bigger, it doesn't exist. The flames have to be there first, and then the fuel to the fire. There's certainly a genetic component to this thing, and I've had people sit in front of me and, well, why do I drink? Maren, just tell me why I drink. Like, it doesn't matter. You're alcoholic. You should really be asking, like, how do I not do this anymore? There we go. Bingo. Let's start with the problem, right? Does everybody have a book? You want to follow along? If you don't and you got it memorized, great. Here's what we're going to look at, right? We're going to start with the good old doctor's opinion, right? And what we're going to do is we're going to chisel this apart a little. We're going to go through this and read it as if we're studying it and as if you've never read it before. I see a couple of big books that are pretty beat up. I love that, right? What do they say about a person with a big book that's fallen apart that their life isn't? Right? So it's like, you know, so I love that. But the point is, right, I was listening to one of my favorite speakers on the way here, and maybe I shouldn't have because he gets me all fired up. His name is Chris Raymer from Ingram, Texas. So I was listening to him on the way in, right, and he was talking about how we always lay on top of the newcomer, how important it is to be open-minded. It's so important to be open-minded and willing. And yet, for the person that's been sober for 20 years, like, they could be as closed-minded as can be. And it's like, no. When do you cross the line of like being able to like be stubborn again? Like, what is there a line? Is it? No, there really isn't. So the idea is, let's take a look at this with an open mind, right? We just read. I love that that prayer in the beginning where it's like, let's just have an open mind and a new experience with like all these things. What's the worst that could happen? We snap back into our old ideas? All right, okay. What's the best thing that could happen? We could be rocketed to a fourth dimension of existence, have a spiritual experience while we're sitting in this church. Why not? Right? That's the worst thing is you go back to the way you were thinking when you walked through the door. It's not even that bad. You came to a big book study. How bad could it be so far, right? Even if you accidentally walked in here, if you're here for the church function, that's probably upstairs. But if you're here for the AA meeting, you saw the words big book next to your little app or little thing. You were flipping through to find a meeting and you thought, well, maybe they're going to talk about something in there. I don't really know. What's this big book, right? You ever go to a meeting before and there's a newcomer, brand new, never been to AA, right? And they walk in, and this was my experience. I walked into a meeting. One of my first AA meetings ever, I was 19 years old. I thought they were going to kick me out because I was too young. I swear to God, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. Back when I had hair. So I walk in, right, and I sit down, and they're talking about their problems, and my girlfriend at the time, she wasn't with me. She was outside waiting for me because she didn't trust me to go anywhere by myself, right? We've all had that before, right? So, and if you haven't, God bless you. But I'm in there, and they're talking about their day, and then this one woman spoke. I think her name was Gail. I can't remember. And she went on and on and on about her relationship with her husband, and how they're always bickering and fighting and this and that and whatever. And then another guy raises his hand. He's like, "Well, I've been divorced twice. I can speak on this." And it's like, there's like. Okay, so I'm there, right? And then I leave, and I tell my girlfriend, I was like, "We should probably see a therapist, you know, because I don't want to turn into what I just heard." And she's like, "Well, I thought you were here to learn to not drink. Like, we didn't know what AA. I didn't know what AA was." And I was like, "Well, they didn't get to that part." An entire hour, my first ever AA meeting, they didn't tell me there was a book. I didn't know anything about the steps except the three steps to walk up to get into the room. That's all I knew. I knew nothing about how to stay sober or anything. But what I did learn is people who are dry drunks tend to fight with their spouse. That's what I learned, right? So here's the idea. I was taught by my sponsor. He said, imagine two different scenarios, right? You go into a meeting, right? Just imagine that you're there and there's a single mother at this meeting. The single mother only gets to go to one AA meeting per week. Because of work obligations, because of the kids, because of everything she's got to do to take care of her family, right? She gets to go to one AA meeting a week, 1 hour, right? Does she get to hear the solution to alcoholism, or does she get to hear about your day? How selfish is it for you to take up any second of that meeting to talk about your day when she's there looking for a solution to alcoholism, and she only gets that 1 hour? It like rocked me back in my chair. Like, what? You're right. And he's like, imagine you go to this meeting. Let's say it's another meeting, right? You go there, and there's a brand new person. It's never even heard of AA before. They were just told they might have to go because they might have a problem with alcohol. And you go there, and you talk about anything other than the solution to alcoholism and maybe the definition of what alcoholism is. How selfish do you have to be to take up any minute of that person's chance to get well and chance to find God? It's like, man. I mean, years and years. And then I was in and out of AA for like 13 years, talking about my day. I'm just checking in from my recovery house. Someone drank my last Pepsi and I got angry. And it's like, what are we doing? And not only that, now it's a little bit different. I'm kind of, aimed it a little bit different at this issue, right? The issue would be, why are we allowing it to happen? Right. Well, I don't want to scare away the newcomer. You mean the newcomer that just came from the worst corner I came from Philly area, right? The worst corner in Kensington, right? You're going to scare them? They just probably had a gun pointed in their face not too long ago. You're going to scare them by talking about the 12 steps? Stop. Scare. Oh, we don't want to talk about God. It might scare them away. Yeah, they say God all the time. Right? Might not be in the context we're thinking about, but when the cop's behind them, right, and they're about to turn their lights on, they're praying to God that they don't.
Right?
Right? They're praying to God that that open sign comes on in that liquor store at 10 a.m. like they said it was gonna. They're praying to God that that guy that's on the corner that's got the dry alcohol in his pocket is gonna be there this week. Praying, right? You don't even know it. Like, I mean, we're scared to talk about God in AA. We're missing something. We're missing something. So let's bring it back to the book. The book talks about the problem, and then it talks about the solution. And it volleys back and forth the entire time. So Dr. Soakworth, if you've done any studying, they call him, his nickname was the little doctor who loved drunks. Right? He was not alcoholic, but he studied people like us. And he got a few of us well. He got one of us well enough to write this book. Right? And his name was Bill Wilson. But it didn't take the first time. Bill Wilson went to Towns Hospital, which is in New York. Towns Hospital was kind of like the recovery centers of America of the time. It was like the place that had the comfy beds, right? And like if you go to an RCA now, like it's got like the Tempur-Pedics and the flat screen TVs, and like it's like nice, right? It's the private insurance spot. Like that's kind of like what Towns Hospital was. It was the upper echelon type of place, right? So he was the head of alcohol and drug addiction in that time. And here's how they were treating. Bill talks about it in his story. He talks about the belladonna treatment. If you're familiar with, anyone ever do any looking up on that? So belladonna is actually a poison if taken in enough quantities. It's the poison that Romeo and Juliet used to commit suicide. I don't know if that's another little AA deep cut if you want to dive into that. But the belladonna treatment, right, was something that they would call the cure at Towns Hospital. It would have a little bit of a mild sedative in it. It would have the belladonna from the juice from the berry in it, and it would have something that would coat the stomach that would calm everything down, right? And they would do they do hydrotherapy, right, which is basically just pump fluids in them, right? And so after a few days at the hospital, these like broken down low bottom drunks are like, I feel great. This is awesome. Like this is incredible. And they would go out, and guess what? They'd come right on back in. After a little bit more bathtub gin, right, and bootlegged alcohol, right, they come right back in, right. So Soakworth was racking he was betting his entire life on people like us, just to watch in pain as we would come back in, or just to hear that, oh well, Mr. or Mrs. So and so passed away, or they went blind because the bathtub gin they mixed up was a little bit of the wrong configuration, right. That was happening too. Right, so at this time we're talking about alcohol, which you know today is kind of socially acceptable. But think about alcohol and what it did during the time of Prohibition. Alcohol changed the constitution of the United States, the founding document of this country, twice. It did it with Prohibition, right? The 18th Amendment. And then it did it on the 21st Amendment when they were like, yeah, we probably shouldn't have done that. We're going to make it legal again, right? It amended our founding document of our country. It was a problem, a political problem, a social problem, and an economic problem. It was an epidemic. That sound like any other epidemics today? That sound familiar? Right? Except they're not making it illegal. They're making it legal through prescription medication. That's a whole other conversation. I won't get into all that today. Right? But my point is they're creating a problem and creating a solution for it using pharmacology. Right? The difference is Silkworth was not trying to do that. He was trying to find a way to holistically help these alcoholics. So what he called moral psychology. Right? Moral meaning the difference between right and wrong, right? And psychology is of the mind. So he was trying to get these alcoholics to realize how wrong it was that they were doing what they were doing, when really it turns out that's not going to fix people like us. Right? Just because I know it's wrong doesn't mean I'm like going to refrain from doing it. Right? That's a story of my life since I was 13. I probably shouldn't, smoke this cigarette, but hey, what the hell? Right? Oh, you know, I got to go to court tomorrow morning. Oh, no big deal. I'll just have a few whiskeys tonight. Right? Oh, doctor says my liver's going to kind of crawl out of my chest if I drink again. Now, you know, maybe I'll just try this Xanax. Right? It's like, it's wild what the mind will do because I need ease and comfort. Right? What the doctor tells me is that that's what we're really after. After all his extensive study, he couldn't really fix people like us, but he knew what could and what would. So then later on, when Bill comes back and he's like, hey, I'd like to talk to your patients about something that I found, he was like, all right. And it turns out there was some groundswell there. Right? It's an interesting concept, right? People who got sober back then and they went through a detox center would go back to the detox center to help the other drunks that were in there. Novel idea. Get it? What are we doing today? If they make it, I'll hope they walk into my home group and I'll talk to them then. Like, what are we waiting for? Anyone else? I mean, you don't have to admit this if you don't want to, but I'm going to openly admit this. Anyone else drink or do any other whatever's outside issues on the way home from detox? Yeah. My window of opportunity of being in pain is very, very small. And that window of opportunity to be willing to listen to anybody or anything is very, very small. So once it snapped shut, I was done. Forget it. Right? Once I walk out of the protective bubble that is treatment and I'm back into the world, right? I need ease and comfort right away. Because so-and-so looked at me funny. And I know I got to talk. Where am I going to live? Well, I got to talk to that person about how bad I hurt him. Or I owe that person money. I can't go back there. Then the world starts to close in on me, right? And then all I need ease and comfort, make it stop. Right? And then sometimes I'll go to gambling first. Next, maybe I'll go to risky sexual behavior, lustful thoughts, gluttonous eating, tons of caffeine. I'll find something. But I'm sober. I'm sober, right? But it's all these other issues, right? I watch these kids at these sober houses, and they're like betting on the game. It's like, whoa. Like, what? We're missing something. Like, I'm not saying that that's going to make you drink again, but I'm not saying it's going to get you closer to God any faster. Right. You'll be praying when you were probably the ones that had Purdue winning the NCAA tournament were probably praying right before they lost the game. Oh God, please don't let them lose. It's going to bust my bracket. Right? Ease and comfort. That's what we're really after. So the doctor's opinion, right? Where if you have a fourth edition. Yeah, okay, cool. So we're XXV, the doctor's opinion. XXV, Roman numerals. I know I'm not Roman either. It took me a little while to figure that out. XXV, doctor's opinion. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Okay, so let's rewind it back even further now. Who's the reader of this book at this time? And don't say you. I mean, when the book was printed. Right? The book was printed, right, back in 1939. It was started to be written between 1937 and 1939, when there was 100 alcoholics. Probably an inflated number. But let's just call it 100. All right? They like round numbers. Yeah, it was exactly 100, right? Yeah. Oh, okay, Bill. Exactly 100. Well, let's call it that. That's fine, right? And then the chief writer was Bill Wilson. Why did he write the book? Anyone know the answer to that? Because he started to see the message already getting watered down between the handful of meetings that they had in the country at the time. He said, if I write a book, they can't screw it up. Now look at us. Screwed it all up. Anyway, so they wrote the book, right? So the reader is, imagine you're on a farm in Kansas in 1942. Try to put yourself there for a second, right? And you got something in the mail, right? It's called the Saturday Evening Post. You guys familiar with that little magazine? You know, everyone used to get the TV guide. Am I aging myself a little bit? Yeah. But yeah, everyone used to get the TV guide, right? You scroll through it and see when Seinfeld was on, even though you knew it was on at 7 o'clock. But you would always just check to make sure. And so it would be this like kind of, it would be articles that would come in, right? And there was an article that came in the Saturday Evening Post. It had the famous picture of the guy in the wife beater shirt, like the guy that depicted AA number 3, Bill Dotz, and the two guys in the suits with books in their hands. They weren't big books, by the way, they were Bibles. But they were sitting, and then the guy sitting on the bed, right, who's all kind of slumped over, right? And then there was a bottle, an empty bottle, like on the bookcase next to him over there, right? So that picture depicted Bill Dotson, who's AA number 3. There was a little bit off in that picture. Bill Dotson got sober actually in Towns Hospital, so there wouldn't have been a bottle of booze there. But anyway, I digress. Either way, that article came called Alcoholics and God, right? And then so that article came out, and they were reading. You're on your farm in Kansas, you're reading this article, you're an alcoholic farmer, okay, you're reading this, and you're thinking like, okay, so there's these handful of people, right, in Akron, Ohio, and in New York, that are not drinking anymore, that were alcoholics, okay, and it said at the end of the article, if you're interested in the program of recovery, send $3 to this little office in New York, and we'll send you a book, right? So you gather up the money to do that, which when I first started saying these statistics, it's different. It was like $50 at the time. Now it's probably like $60 with inflation. Let's call it $60. So what you would be doing is you'd be sitting with your spouse at your kitchen table having a discussion about this article that we're reading together, saying, well, I should probably get this book. Let's get $60 together and just send it to New York, to the big city. Send it to New York, and hopefully they send back this book, right? So they got their money together, they sent it out, and it came back, the book, right? So that's what we're talking about. This is the reader, Farm, Kansas, 1943, right? So when this is, so again, they want to add legitimacy to this big book. It's not just a bunch of alcoholics saying, hey, this is what we do not to drink anymore. We're going to put the doctor's opinion right up in the front. The reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the program of recovery described in this book, right? So we want to make sure that the reader knows that there's some medical legitimacy to this. That's why it's right up front. That's the very first sentence, right, in the doctor's opinion. Just to let the reader know. Alcoholic farmer in Kansas in 1943. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. That's a promise. Right off the rip. Right? That's a promise. And witnessed our return to health. Bingo. Right? So when you're reading this as the reader on a farm out in Kansas in 1942, the thought is, I can get healthy. Right? Have we ever told that to a newcomer before? Oh, hey, welcome to AA. The coffee's over there. The bathroom's down the hall. Let's hear about my day. No. How about have a seat? Are you interested in doing whatever it takes to get well? You can get healthy again. Interested in that? Right? Bingo. Get right from the rip. They've got the reader's attention. First couple sentences of the doctor's opinion. Okay, so there's medical legitimacy. That's one. Right? There's a promise right here that I can get returned to health. They have experience with that. Right? That's right off the rip. A well-known doctor and chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. right? So this is Silkworth who wrote this letter. There's actually two versions of the letter, and we'll see as we get through the doctor's opinion. This is the first one. Dr. Silkworth did not put his name on this letter. He knew it was going to be published in this book, but he did not put his name on it. There's a very big reason for that. Doctors at that time were viewed upon as gods, almost, if you think about it. Right? You ever hear the term doctor's orders? Right? So they would do whatever the doctor said. Remember? I mean, I don't know if anyone remembers this, but doctors were prescribing cigarettes to pregnant women at some points. Just saying, it was a thing. Right? And they were giving buckets of opium to people, to housewives. It just was wild. But anyway, they didn't know what they didn't know. Blah, blah, blah. Doesn't really matter. The point is, right, we're making sure that right now, when Dr. Silkworth gave this letter, he's giving it to, and this book ultimately is going to say, doctors can't help you, God can. Right? Silkworth's probably like, yeah, I'm not going to put my name on that. I'll write the letter, sure. But I'm not going to put my medical kind of, repertoire on the line just on this little fledgling society that's just starting off right now. Like, that's not, he's not willing to do that right away. Right? So, to whom it may concern, I've specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had had a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of the type I have come to regard as hopeless. He's talking about Bill. Right? So he's saying, I have come to regard as hopeless. Like, oof. Right? Imagine being in that doctor's office and the doctor looks at you and goes, yeah, you're hopeless, pal. Good luck. Right? I want to make sure I get your front and back of your insurance card before you leave. Like, damn. It's rough. That's rough. Like, a guy that specialized in, what did he call it? The treatment of alcoholism. I specialize in the treatment of alcoholism. You're hopeless. Right? I'm a specialized foot doctor. We got to chop your foot off. It's like, ooh. Like, that's exactly what he's saying. This guy was hopeless. That I had come to regard as hopeless. He, the doctor, right? In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing on them that they must do likewise still with others. We miss that part a lot in AA. And right, and it's somewhat comical when we were reading the preamble, like that part got split up. All right, the main purpose is to stay sober. Oh, and, not or, not and slash or, and help others to recover from alcoholism, right? So this is the main crux of what Bill was saying to Silkworth in the very beginning. Hey, I have to do this and help other people. And they have to do it with others. Rock on, right? That's literally what this is saying. When Bill went to Silkworth in the very beginning, after his third treatment, he came up with some ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. And the only way it's going to work is if I help other people. Oh, and not only that, but they have to help other people too. Like, that's the crux of the solution to alcoholism. That's for major bonus points. By bonus points, I mean living happy, joyous, and free. Not just being sober. The book tells me later on, right, we feel a man is unthinking if he said sobriety is enough. It's not. Right? This is the more. Right. There's one of my sponsors. His name is Mark Houston. Right. If you guys ever heard of Mark Houston, excellent man. And he would always say, always, never miss it a beat, I smell more. No matter how well you think you are, I smell more. And that's what the more is. In the beginning, we come in to learn how to not drink. And it turns out there's way more. It's way more than that. We get to help others to recover from alcoholism. And they, in turn, get to help others to recover from alcoholism. Not have to, get to. Right? I shouldn't be alive. Honestly. I can't even count the number of times I got behind the wheel of a car somewhat intoxicated. I can't even... The number is... I just can't even imagine the number. Right? I shouldn't be here today. There's certain medications that brought me back to life more than once. I shouldn't be here today. Right? And the fact that I get to be here, I get to talk about this, I get to shout great tidings of what God can do and what AA can do and what the 12 steps can do is nothing short of miraculous. Nothing short. I don't call it my sobriety date for a very specific reason. I hear people say that all the time. My sobriety date is. That's not my sobriety date. That was gifted to me. It's not mine. God saw fit to remove my obsession for drugs and their derivatives that day. It was not me. Afterwards, sure, there's some things that I had to do, some work I had to do to maintain that, of course, right? But that's not my sobriety date, right? That's really the people that I'm helping. It's my sponsees. That's theirs. They get that, right? My wife gets that. My three kids get that. It's not mine. You ever hear an AA? You got to give it away to keep it. You ever hear that? Mm-hmm. That's the opposite of what the book says. The book does not say give it away to keep it anywhere. It says you have to give it away to get it. You have to give it away to get it. And that's what he's talking about. Bill talking about it during the course of his third treatment. I need to give this away right now. I can't keep any of this. Keeping it is selfish. And that's our problem. Selfishness is self-centered. That we think is the root of our troubles. I'm going to get sober so I can do this. And I'm working on my character defects. And I'm doing this and I'm doing that. It's like, jeez, how much more selfish can you get? Read the Daily Reflections. It's the most selfish book I ever read in my life. I'm going to do this today. And I'm going to do this. And I'm this. All right, so where's God in all this? Nowhere? Oh, cool. Rock on. Good luck. Good luck with that. Because if you're a real alcoholic like me, it's got, I can't fix me. I'm a broken transmission. I can't fix myself. Right? I need a higher power, a cosmic mechanic in this scenario, to fix me. And then to maintain it. Right? That's it. There's no secrets to this thing. There's no magic pill. There's no anything crazy. Take the 12 steps. Do whatever it says. Help other people along the way. I wish it was more complex. It's so damn easy. Is damn a bad word? I hope I didn't just mess this up. It's so easy that we need to complicate it. Well, I need to learn about this. And what about the Jungian theory behind alchemy? And I can talk about dreams. And All right. That's cool. Like, I'll go. Without Carl Jung, none of us are here, by the way. Right? This book's not here. Okay, that's cool. Let's study that. There's nothing wrong with any of that. Like, that's awesome, right? And there's a lot of good doctors and therapists, right? Page 133 says doctors, therapists, and counselors are indispensable to the newcomer. It tells me in the book on page 133, indispensable, right, to their newcomer in the case afterwards. Like, rock on. Like, that's all good. Nothing wrong with any of that, right? But we need to clear the gunk out from here first before we're going to be able to hear any of that. I need to clear out the blockages between my head and my heart. I've been running on this for so long, right? That God's in here the whole time. I'm sorry if I just spoiled the end of the book for you, right? But you got a little pilot light in here, right? And it's just not getting a lot of air, just enough for you to breathe in and out and stay alive. Thank God for that, right? We need to get some more air to that thing. How do we do that? We ask God to remove our character defects out of the way so it gets some more air in there, right? And then by the time it gets, so it's really shining, then what? The heat goes out. We share with other people, right? That's what he's explaining in here, right? This has become the basis. Hold on. Now we're getting the basis of the fellowship. You ready? The basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of men and their families. These men and over 100 others appear to have recovered. That must be a typo. Recovered? Come on. But the basis of the fellowship is what? Not staying sober. We must stay sober to carry the message, yes. But the basis of the fellowship is helping others. That's what it just told me. In Dr. Silkworth's first letter, first page, we've got almost everything we need to get rocking and rolling here on what the program is and what it is not. Right on this first page. So the basis of the fellowship is what? Helping others. Commence to present misconceptions to other alcoholics. That's the basis of the fellowship. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type who other methods had completely failed. Let's talk about other methods for a second. What kind of other methods was he using? The belladonna treatment was one, right? Another thing they used to do with alcoholics is electroshock therapy. That's very real. They did that. Ever see the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or read the book? Like that. Wet sponges, right? Electrodes, shock brain. That's what they used to do. They used to give us opiates, right? I mean, there was all sorts of different types of methods that they were trying to do to fix the alcoholic from the outside in. Turns out the fix is from the inside out. Right, and that's what Bill is trying to impress upon the new people at this point. But that's what they're talking about and helping others. Right, but so those were the other methods. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of a rapid growth inherent in this group that they make mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. Right, so epoch in the annals of alcoholism is kind of like a blip on the timeline, like a punch on the timeline, like a little spot, right, of alcoholism. What is it? He said it's important medically to this, right? So he's merging, in a way, spirituality and the medical world. And he's saying that the medical world better look at this because it's somewhat important, that it might make a new kind of point on the timeline of alcoholism in general. So let's make sure we don't miss this. By the way, the medical fraternity is still missing this up to this point. Just my humble opinion. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely on absolutely anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William Duncan Silkworth. Great letter, right, from the rip, good. But of course, as alcoholics, and Bill being Bill, was not good enough. And we'll hear why, right? The physician who at our request gave us this letter had been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. He's going to give a little synopsis of the statement here. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. If you got a highlighter or if you haven't highlighted this yet, this is what it's literally telling the alcoholic must believe this. Must. Not maybe. Not like, okay, I'll consider it. Must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. This is where we're falling into the idea of the physical allergy and the mental obsession. Right? He's going to go into that in the letter. Right? What it is we truly suffer from. Right? Physical allergy is defined as an abnormal reaction to a substance. Right? If someone's allergic to strawberries, right, that when I ingest a strawberry, one, it's delicious, and nothing happens to me. I get a little rush of dopamine and serotonin and everything. That's very good. I like this. I enjoy it. I might have another, right? That's my reaction when I have a strawberry. If someone's allergic to strawberries, their reaction is quite different. Their tongue might swell up, their face might swell up, their throat might close, they might die. Very different reaction, right? One is normal and one is abnormal. That's what an allergy is defined as. So as an alcoholic, we have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, right? An abnormal reaction to a shot of Jack Daniels is, wow, that makes my life better. I should do as much of that as I can humanly ingest right away. Right? That's an abnormal reaction. Alcohol is a central nervous system depressant, by the way. The normal reaction to something like whiskey is they get like a hurting stomach or they get tired. Right? I don't know about you, but my reaction when I put alcohol in my system was not tiredness. I was like, let's go. I got to go to work tomorrow. I'll find a new job. Let's go to AC. Right? I have a much different reaction to all of that than the general population. Right? The same with other substances. I could go into all that. Maybe we'll talk about it after the meeting. But my reaction is very, very, very different. I put a central nervous system depressant in my body. My first thought is, let's clean the fish tank. Let's clean the house. Let's go to work. Whatever. Like, let's go. Go, 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 go. Some people get home, they have a beer or whatever, and they feel relaxed. Everything is good. Cool. My reaction is very different. All right, so I have a much different reaction. So that's the allergy, right? I do not react the same as other people. That's the physical component, is what he's talking about. That's what we must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. One is not greater than the other. And what's the mind say? Yeah, I reacted poorly last time. It's like someone who's allergic to strawberries saying, it'll be different this time. I'm just going to have one more strawberry. Right? I just got out of the hospital with an allergic reaction. It almost died to my strawberry allergy. And my next thought is like, yeah, I'm going to try another one of those. Be different this time. Right? That's the abnormality of the physical allergy. And then the mind that says it's okay. It'll be different this time. Those are that's really what we're up against. Right? If it was just an abnormal reaction, an allergy, the mind wouldn't say to do it again. It would say, don't do that. It'd be like, if you're allergic to strawberries and there's a salad that you're going to get that has strawberries on it, more than likely you'd be like, yeah, I'm good on that. Can we either take the strawberries, remove that, or I'll just get something different? And then as opposed to the mind saying, you know what, put extra strawberries on it. I think it'll be different this time. Right? That's the difference, right? But they're both just as abnormal, as he calls it. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or outright mental defectives. What he means is, in this sentence, he's saying, I didn't like the idea of just being mentally handicapped. Right? But it turns out there's a physical component too. These things were true to some extent. That's a chuckler. In fact, a considerable extent to some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well, and our belief that any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we could not otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on a spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery and befogged. What did that sentence just tell us? The solution to alcoholism. It just gave, there's your answer. What do I have to do to get better? It turns out we work out a solution on a spiritual as well as an altruistic plane. Altruistic, right? That means thinking of others before you're thinking of yourself. Right? So on a spiritual as well as an altruistic plane. It's funny, the wording of all this. Bill Wilson and Carl Jung had a letter. They wrote a letters back and forth. Really, it was just one back and forth. Like, Bill wrote Carl Jung saying, hey, thanks, buddy. We appreciate what you did for Roland Hazard, which we'll get to in the next few weeks. Thank you for what you did with him. Told him the truth. This is what happened. This is how AA came about. You're the man. Thank you. Carl Jung wrote a letter back. And he was like, he didn't know really what had happened to Roland. It wasn't like Carl Jung could go on Facebook and see what was going on with Roland Hazard in Vermont, right? It was like that didn't exist. Like, there wasn't like a lot of communication between Switzerland, which is where Carl Jung was, and a little town in Vermont, which is from where Roland Hazard was from. That's where Ebby was from. That's where Bill was from. The same area, right? So it's like there wasn't a lot of information going back and forth. So when Carl Jung got this letter, he thought it was great, wrote back, and then at the very end, in the sentence before he signed off on the letter, he wrote a Latin term. He said, it's kind of funny how the same, right, poison that we're talking about has the same name as a higher being of humanity, right? And he called it spiritus contra spiritum, which is spirit versus spirit. Right, so they call it wine and spirits, right? Right, and in Pennsylvania, that's on the outside of all the liquor stores, or wine and spirits stores, right? And then what we're talking about in AA is a spiritual experience, right? If anyone's like me, I was, I'll never forget it. 12 years old in the woods in upstate New York, up in the Adirondack Park where I grew up, right? 6 beers in one night, 12-year-old kid. The definition of a spiritual experience is a profound change in perception. I'll tell you, the spirit of alcohol gave me a spiritual experience at the age of 12 in upstate New York. I had a spiritual experience that day. My perception on life changed forever. Right? Someone comes into AA and they say, well, I can't have a spiritual experience. Like, bro, that's why you're here. You've had dozens. if not thousands of spiritual experiences. Right? First time you put alcohol in your system is a spiritual experience. First time you were just had just enough liquor in you to go up and ask that girl to the dance, or ask that guy to the dance, or ask that person to marry you, or ask whatever, like whatever it was. Like that you've had a profound change of perception because of the spirit of alcohol. That is the definition of a spiritual experience. Right? So spirituality is not lost on the alcoholic. You don't have to believe in God to believe in spirituality because you've had spiritual experiences. You ever fall in love? I've done it more times than I'd like to admit. That's a spiritual experience. It's a profound change in perception, right? My wife and I are blessed to have 3 children. Each one, spiritual experience after spiritual experience. My perception on life changed forever when those children were born and I looked at them in the eyes. Right? We've had thousands of them. Everyone in this room collectively, there's probably a million of them. Just this room. And yet when the newcomer comes into AA and say, I can't be spiritual. And we don't combat that at all. Yes, you can. Yes, you have. The fact that you walked into AA, you've had a spiritual experience. Your perception has changed just walking in here saying you have an issue with alcohol. You don't have to tell me you have an issue with alcohol. But you walked into AA. Ding, ding, ding. I got an idea that you have an issue with alcohol. Just saying. I'm no doctor. I'm no therapist. I'm not even that smart. But I know when you walk into AA, you don't do it because you won the lottery.
Right.
Or you got the job. You don't walk into AA because it's just like, you know what? It's Sunday night. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to AA. Like, no one's doing that. But when you walk in here and then you tell me, I can't have a spiritual experience, my first thought is, yeah, you can. You've had thousands. Right? So what's the difference? The difference is, all we're asking is for you to be open enough to have a spiritual experience using this. Right? So what's the solution? What did he just tell me? Right? He literally just told me the solution on a spiritual as well as, not and, not or, as well as, in combination, 2 things, an altruistic plane. And of course, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery and befogged. Why? Because alcohol withdrawal can kill you. That and benzodiazepines will kill you, withdrawal. It's important to go to the hospital. It's important to detox. That's what he's saying. Of course, and plus he's a doctor, so he's going to be like, yeah, pretty important. He knows. But he's again, with Bill, is saying through Dr. Silkworth's experience, right? But Bill is saying, this is how we work out our solution. We can't miss this stuff. You ever been to a big book study where they read the whole chapter? Right? It's not even a big book study. They read the whole chapter, and then afterwards they don't talk about the chapter at all. Like, let's study it line by line like we're doing here. We literally have, in just these 2 pages, found out what the problem is and what the solution is. Right? And maybe we need a little bit more convincing. That's okay. That's what the next 60 pages are for of the book. Right? Think about the breakdown of the book. All right? And we'll read a little bit more in a second. So let's just take the literal just page numbers. Okay? So on page 60, right? So if we're going to take the doctor's opinion to page 60 is this piece of the book. Right? Sorry for anyone who's on the recording. I'm just taking the portion of the book, right? This thin piece, right? What is this really describing up to page 60, right? Basically, the first 2 steps. Really, what the problem is, right? Where the solution lies. There's a chapter called There is a Solution, which is also a promise, by the way. The title of that chapter, There is a Solution. Right? You're a farmer out in Kansas in 1943, and the chapter says there's a solution. There's some hope there. Bingo! Pretty cool, right? So then this is your first, right, kind of learning about it, right? And then from page 60 to page 89, right? 88. This thin piece, the thinnest piece here, steps 3 through 11, right? So it means something important. And then, of course, 89 to 164. What's that all about? Bigger chunk. Step 12. Right? That's the carrying of the message. in different ways and different avenues, right? So the thinnest piece of the book we're talking about, 60 to 88. I'm not great at math. Sounds like 28 pages. Is that right? Someone get an abacus out and we can figure this out. Okay? 28 pages to freedom. Remember the old Sublime song, 40 ounces to freedom? We're a little bit different today, right? But then again, that 40 ounces of freedom, there's your spiritual experience, right? That's what he's talking about. The guy died of a drug overdose or something. Like he, you know, he's one of us, that's for sure. Brad Noel, I think, was his name, right? But that's what he called it, 40 ounces to freedom, right? What are we talking about here? Happy, joyous, and free. Freedom. We watch through the arc of freedom. Like he talks about it over and over and over again. Request across the bridge of reason to freedom. Right? That's what he's discussing. And this many, right? Step 3 to step 11, 28 pages. What does that mean exactly? Again, you want to know what you suffer from in the beginning. Once you know what you suffer from, rock on. And then you take the action to get better. And that's what's in here, right? The action steps. The chapter's called Into Action, right? How it works, which is another promise, by the way. How it works, right? And then into action, right directly after that. Not into contemplation, not into thinking, not into wondering, not into the therapy office, none of those things. Into action. This is what needs to get done. Right, so we need to again learn. So, from the doctor's opinion, right, the solution is basically spelled out. We need spirituality to get there, right, and we need to work with others to get there. That's what the basis of the fellowship is helping other people. Okay, rock on. Now, what do I do? I'm on a farm out in Kansas. I'm reading this, right? What do I do? So I should go to the hospital if I'm jittery or befogged, okay? More often than not, it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, and then you have a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. There's another little piece for you. What is he saying there? Being approached. It just taught me how to sponsor. Right? Read between the lines, just a little bit. You don't have to read between the lines. This is what it says. A man's brain better to be cleared before he is approached. Does it say that he's got to go to his local AA meeting and go find a sponsor? No. They should be approached. That's why Bill would go back to the hospital and approach the people there. Because he knew they probably wouldn't make it to him ever. If given an opportunity for them to get out first. It's a different time now. I get it. Like you can accidentally walk into an AA meeting. Like I understand all that. Like we're everywhere. I get it. But still, if we're going to kind of take this back to what the promises of the book were, why wouldn't we do what the book says? Right after someone's brain is cleared, as he called it, right, or detoxed, they should be approached. That's the best time to approach them. We're going to wait 90 days while they're sitting on a Tempur-Pedic bed watching March Madness in rehab, getting three hots in a cot and like writing whatever and finger painting and learning their triggers and whatever, right? Milking the insurance for all it's worth, and then they finally come out and then they're 90 days sober without a change up here. The same brain that went in is the same brain that came out. And remember, that same brain that went in said alcohol was a good idea the last time they relapsed. The thinking needs to change. And I'm not just saying for the newcomer. I'm saying for the people that should be doing the approaching. The thinking needs to change. Because if we don't change something about this, the numbers keep going up. The number of deaths from alcohol in the United States keep going up. The number of deaths from overdoses keep going up. Like you could have any politicized reason for any of that, and that's okay. And you can scream those problems from the rooftop, but that's not a solution. We're on the ground level here. This is where the solution is. Here, AA, right? What are we doing here? What are we teaching the new people here when they somehow stumble into AA? Oh, here you go, little Johnny. Here, have a seat right here. All right, we're going to love you till you love yourself. Make 90 meetings in 90 days, and you'll be fine. Don't worry about the steps. You can do those a little bit later on. You ever hear anyone? I was told that for years. That exact same thing. We'll love you till you love yourself. Like, I don't know if anyone's ever been to like any of these AA clubhouses. And they'll have like these cork boards up. They're like in memory cork boards, right? And they'll put the people that died from the illness, and they'll put their, you know, their I don't know what they're called. There's those obituary cards from the funerals, and they'll put them up there, and they'll tack them up there, and their heart's in the right place. It's like, you know, this is someone who passed away. You know, they probably shouldn't have, or maybe they weren't ready for the solution, or maybe they, you know, they just weren't ready for all this, or who knows what the reasoning is behind all that. And like, it's sad. Right, and it's unnecessary, because seeing that corkboard isn't going to make me not drink. I'll tell you that for sure. Right, it's a doctor's opinion is going to call it frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices, meaning if you love me enough, you'll stop. You're going to die if you don't stop. Right, that's not enough for somebody like me. I'll figure something else out. Or I'll leave those people and go find a tribe of people that will co-sign my drinking. Right? That's what I'll do. I'll just get away from that noise. Right? So the idea is something's got to change. The numbers aren't getting better. They're getting worse. What was the success rate of AA back when the book was written? There's some, you know, people who might say, well, there were less people, so the numbers were better. Like, okay, but let's just go by the numbers. Strictly analytical. All right. When the foreword to the second edition was written in 1955, it said 50% of people got sober at once. 50%. I'm not great at math. That sounds like half. All right. And then another 25% after a couple relapses. Right? So let's just go on the low number, 50%. Imagine, right, if this meeting, there was a sign outside, right next to where it says, like, down the hallway to the left, right? Right. On that sign, it was big, bright neon sign that said, 50% of alcoholics who walk in here will never drink again. Do you think there'd be more people in this room? Yeah, the line would be out the door. Right? The line would be out the door. Anyone ever Google AA success rate? If you're, like, easily depressed, don't do it. It's like 3 to 8%. Not 38. No. 3 to 8%. So what I ask myself is, what's the difference between then and now? Nice little book written by Wally P. called Back to Basics. Anyone here ever read that book? Oh, gotta read that book. So it talks about, there was a group in Cleveland, Ohio. So this group, second group in Ohio, write it down, guys, for everybody. So this group, right, here's what they would do. They would go out and find drunks. They'd go out and find them. They'd go out and find them at bars. They'd go out and find them at hospitals. Wherever they could find drunk people, laying on the side of the road, whatever. They would go find them. And they would bring them to this group. And this group would meet every single week, once a week. And what they would do is they'd have two facilitators. They'd be sitting up here like this, and there'd be a group of people like this. And I'd bring some little drunk, right? Let's call it little Timmy. I'd bring little Timmy in, and I'd sit next to him, and I'd take care of him while he was there. He'd be shaking. I'd get him coffee, I'd do whatever. I'd clean up his mess that he was spilling, whatever, right? And during these classes, what they would do is they would go over three steps a week. Again, not great at math, but that's 4 weeks. If little Timmy got through the 4 weeks, he would be considered what's called a card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous. They'd fill out this little card, right? This is it's little Timmy, right? It had his name on there, first and last name, by the way. It'd be on there. And then it would have the place where the class was held, and then it would have the signature of the facilitator and the signature of the sponsor, which was the person that brought him in. At that point, and that point only, could little Timmy go to the actual AA meeting that was held upstairs at the same time every week. What do you think the success rate of that group for anyone that made it to the upstairs was? 90%. 90% of the people that got a card in Cleveland, Ohio, became card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous, never drank again. 90%. It's the exact flip today of success rates. What was being stressed then that's not being stressed now? The steps. Done. That's what they, the level of importance that was placed on the steps was dramatic. It's the only thing it was about. Right? And what about meeting formats? It also discusses that in the book. There were two meeting formats back then. And remember, the second edition was written in 1955. So it had some time between 1939 and 1955 to get these numbers, right? So during that time, something dramatically changed in the early 60s, by the way. Treatment centers, and there's a whole thing. But there's so something dramatically changed then. But up until 1955, there were two meeting formats. Two. One was a big book study, like this, where they would study the book. They go through it line by line. They bring newcomers in to study the book, right? And the second format was a speaker meeting. And the only way you could speak at the speaker meeting was if you were helping other alcoholics. That was your criteria. Didn't matter how long you were sober. Didn't matter how many 24s. None of that matters. Sobriety time means as much as your shoe size in AA. I'm sorry, but I mean, I put a couple 24s together. That doesn't mean anything. It means it really doesn't. If anyone wants to change sobriety dates with me, let's do it. Fine. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't. The point is, what are we actually doing with that time? What are we giving back to AA? Who are we helping and what are we reading? That's always what my sponsor would say to me. I'd call him up with some catastrophic thing that's going on in my life. Blah, 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 just spouting, sobbing. Every single time, to this day, if I were to do something like that, I would call him up and blah, 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 and he would ask me those two questions. Okay, Maren, that's great. Yep. Who are you helping and what are you reading? It's a Jefferson Airplane. They wrote a song. And in that song, one of the famous lyrics, right, is feed your head. Here we're talking about acid, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about like spiritual reading. Like what are we feeding our head? What are we listening to? Who are we talking with? What are we absorbing? What are the inputs, right? It's like an Excel spreadsheet, right? The information that comes from that spreadsheet is only as good as what's getting put in. Like, what are the inputs? What inputs are we getting every single day? I challenge you to think back today. From when you woke up to right this second, what inputs have there been? Right? Stressful day. I mean, it's Sunday. I don't know how stressful it could be, but whatever. Who knows what's going on? Maybe there's some things at home that are going on. Maybe we're getting a lot of negative inputs from outside. Right? And that might change our chemistry on the inside. Right? It might lower our dopamine serotonin response. It might bring us into more of the depths of a kind of depressive place. But I read something on it's kind of embarrassing, but there's a, what time is it anyway, by the way? Okay, real quick. I read this thing on a Yogi tea. Yes, a tea, right? On the little thing where you dunk the tea in. It said joy cannot be destroyed, right? So it's like real joy, right? If we have it, if you got it, it really can't be taken away. Sure, the inputs can change some things, but at the same time. So next week, what we'll do is we'll finish up the doctor's opinion, we'll read the second letter, and we'll dive into a little bit of what he's going to talk about with AA history, with Roland Hazard and Carl Jung. And we'll dive into that stuff. So thank you guys for having me again. I really appreciate it.